fighting engineers fled, maintenance wasn't done, and after it was taken back with coalition airstrikes and Iraqi security forces, some key equipment was missing. And also, since it was taken back, that crucial maintenance hasn't happened as it should, partly because of logistical problems. It's very close to ISIS-held areas. Now, an Italian company has agreed to maintain the dam, but they will need months to get set up there. So this is not a problem we're seeing a solution to quickly.
Well, 2 years into ISIS control of Mosul, the big talk is of taking back Mosul. Where exactly does that stand?
Well, yesterday, the Iraqi Ministry of Defense said the operation to retake Mosul had begun. They are honestly probably overstating things a little bit. What has actually happened is that some clearing operations have begun close to a small town called Mahmur, which is about 50 miles southeast of Mosul. Now, Mahmur is interesting at the moment because it's where a lot of the training is happening of groups of fighters who it's hoped will one day move into Mosul. And that includes Americans training Iraqi security forces, among others. But the various bases there have been repeatedly hit by ISIS missiles. And as you mentioned, a Marine who was providing protection for the training was killed a few days ago and others were injured. So actually, although the commanders are saying this is the beginning of the Mosul operation, other soldiers in the area speaking to us are saying the goal was basically to secure those villages close to those bases.
What other role, if any, is the US playing in these first steps towards Mosul?
So American military officials have cautioned that they are expecting tens of thousands of troops to be necessary to actually retake the city. They're participating actively in training them, but they don't say that they're trained or ready to be deployed just yet. Of course, there are coalition airstrikes in support of these latest missions and also ongoing inside the city. There was an incident at the weekend, in fact, a Facebook group where Mosul journalists report anonymously on what happens there said there was a huge airstrike on the university at the weekend, which was a place ISIS had been using as a headquarters. They also say there were up to 20 civilian deaths in that strike. The United States says only that it's assessing those allegations. And political officials, like the president's special envoy to the anti-ISIS coalition, Brett McGurk, have also said that Mosul operations are already ongoing because there have been joint Iraqi and coalition battles that have taken strategic roads and towns close to Mosul. But the battle for the city itself probably is still some way off.
NPR's Alice Fordham, speaking to us from Erbil in northern Iraq. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Renee.
Peabody Energy is one of the world's largest coal companies, and recently its leaders recommended that the company file for bankruptcy. If the coal giant does go under, it would be the latest in a string of major coal producers to file for Chapter 11. But many mines owned by bankrupt companies are still blasting dynamite and scooping up coal. Inside Energy's Lee Patterson reports on what bankruptcy really means in the coal business.
At the end of last year, more than one-third of the coal produced in Wyoming was mined by a company in bankruptcy.
I'm very worried about what's going to happen.
That's Gene Wagner, a former miner who lives in Gillette, Wyoming.
Because coal mining has done a lot for the communities, and it's done a lot for the people that work at them.
But bankruptcy does not mean that a business just shuts down, and it's not all that uncommon. Last year, around 6,000 companies filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Under that scenario, a company comes up with a reorganization plan that allows it to stay alive and pay back some of its debts over time. One thing companies often do is cut jobs.
It's a common story here in eastern Kentucky. The coal industry continues to see round after round of layoffs.
TV news station WYMT reported on potential cuts at Alpha Natural Resources in July, just weeks before the coal producer declared bankruptcy. According to data from S&P Global Market Intelligence, Central Appalachia lost around 19% of its coal mining jobs last year. In Wyoming, the drop was a lot smaller, just 1.5%. But coal production in Wyoming has fallen by 14% since 2011. State revenues from that production are down too. And then there's another impact to worry about: cuts to retiree benefits like medical and life insurance. Cecil Roberts is the union president of the United Mine Workers of America.
When it comes to bankruptcy, the ones that lose the most are the workers and the retirees.
Roberts was arrested a few years ago at a protest in West Virginia. Crowds gathered to demonstrate against Patriot Coal, a spinoff of Peabody Energy, because the company was trying to reduce benefits for thousands of unionized workers. bankrupt Alpha Natural Resources recently asked for permission to cut medical and life insurance for nearly 5,000 non-union retirees. In court documents, the company refers to this $125 million liability as a, quote, financial burden. And the uncertainty for coal communities doesn't end there.
I think there's a very significant potential problem and risk to the taxpayer with the pretty high-profile bankruptcies that have taken place recently with coal companies.
That was Sally Jewell, the Interior Secretary, at a recent Senate hearing, answering questions about another concern, recovering coal mine reclamation costs. That's the funding to put the land back the way it was before mining began. Across the country, major bankrupt coal companies have hundreds of millions of dollars in cleanup liabilities. These are among the many debts being dealt with in bankruptcy court. And here's the thing. Although bankruptcy can mean serious short-term pain in coal communities, many are rooting for companies to work through it because shutting down completely could be even worse. That's the outcome Pat Sweeney's hoping for. He's advocated for Western land issues for over 40 years.
From our point of view, we want coal companies that continue to operate because a viable coal company is the one who's the best at reclaiming the land.
Negotiations are ongoing between bankrupt coal companies and their creditors over all kinds of debts. But at least in one recent case, there's a bill that will likely be paid. In January, a bankruptcy judge approved up to $12 million in bonuses for executives at Alpha Natural Resources. For NPR News, I'm Lee Patterson.
And that story comes from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration that focuses on America's energy issues.
And yesterday brought us the sad news that comedian Gary Shandling has died of an apparent heart attack at the age of 66. Long before TV shows like The Office and Parks and Recreation made the mock documentary popular, there was The Larry Sanders Show. Gary Shandling's 1990s HBO show went behind the scenes at a make-believe late-night talk show with Shandling as the neurotic host Larry Sanders. Here's Larry chatting with actor Alec Baldwin.
Well, actually, Larry, you know, you and I have something in common.
Yes. Yes, we do. A lot of you probably don't know that Alec and I, Alec used to actually date my ex-wife, Francine.
No, I was referring to our charity work with multiple sclerosis.
I know that too.
And late night host paid tribute to Shandling. Here's Conan O'Brien on his show.
He was a masterful writer, a performer who went on to create incredibly groundbreaking comedy shows that inspired an entire generation of comedians, myself included.
Remembering Gary Shandling, who died yesterday. And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:18, and you've tuned in to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. The latest news is coming up next from NPR and WPR. House Speaker Paul Ryan says it may be time for criminal justice reform. More on that story from WPR's Gilman Halstead in a couple minutes.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, this week featuring apples from Half's Road Orchard for all of your cooking, baking, and snacking needs. The market is open Saturdays from 9 to 1 in the lobby of the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha.
There's performance opportunities to a diverse mix of Madison area students. WPR is pleased to support young people in the arts. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Authorities in Belgium and Germany are busy today rounding up possible suspects connected to this week's bombings in Brussels. Police raids in and around Brussels have resulted in at least 6 people being detained. In Germany, 2 people are under arrest. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Brussels with a message for those behind the bombings claimed by ISIS that left 31 people dead, including 2 Americans.
We will not be deterred, and we will come back with greater resolve, with greater strength, and we will not rest until we have eliminated your nihilistic beliefs and cowardice from the face of this earth.
The bombings left more than 300 people wounded. A budget crisis could force Atlantic City, New Jersey to temporarily shut down. Joe Hernandez with member station WHYY says lawmakers are considering putting the resort town under state control.
Mayor Don Guardian promised earlier this week that essential employees would stay on the job, police officers, firefighters, sanitation workers. Now he says many non-essential employees have also agreed to keep working. Guardian says the city will pay those workers back wages in early May when it gets its next influx of tax payments.
And there's no trading today on Wall Street because of Good Friday. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. House Speaker Paul Ryan says it's time for Congress to make redemption rather than punishment the centerpiece of the country's criminal justice policy. The Wisconsin congressman says it's time to fix the problems created by the war on drugs. Gilman Halstead reports.
In a recent speech on the state of American politics, Ryan said he and other policymakers in the 1990s overcompensated in their tough-on-crime approach to fighting the war on drugs. He says harsh sentencing laws destroyed the lives of many nonviolent offenders and their communities, and he says it's time for a change.
We need to make redemption something that is valued in our culture, in our society, and in our laws, so that when a young man comes out of prison who did something where he really needed addiction counseling, he needed some other kinds of mentoring, maybe faith, that he can actually go back and be a productive member of society.
The bills Ryan is backing now would reduce sentences for nonviolent crimes and boost funding for reentry services for offenders after their release from prison. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin's unemployment rate did not budge last month. Preliminary data the State Department of Workforce Development released yesterday shows the state's unemployment rate was 4.6% in February, unchanged from January. The national unemployment rate was 4.9% in February. The state added a total of 7,200 non-farm jobs last month. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Epson, with the EcoTank line of SuperTank printers, all-in-one printers featuring refillable ink tanks that come with up to 2 years of ink in the box. Where there's business, there's Epson. Learn more at epson.com/forbusiness. From CarMax, offering more than 40,000 used cars and trucks online and in store, with over 150 locations from coast to coast. Learn more at CarMax.com. CarMax, the bright side of car buying. And from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at LumberLiquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne in Culver City, California.
And I'm David Green in Oakland, California. We are wrapping up a week broadcasting from here at Youth Radio. Some things we planned for. We wanted to listen to stories about young people reported by young journalists. Some things we did not plan for. We did not know we'd be covering a terrorist attack in Europe from here. One listener took note. She tweeted that hearing us from Youth Radio reminded her that we need to leave young people with a better world. And I've got to say, seeing these young faces was somehow comforting during this difficult week. I had a chance to chat with some of the young journalists here about their future.
I am sitting around a table with three Youth Radio reporters. Desmond Megley is 19 years old. He's to my left. Desmond, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Kenshay Sakris, you're 17 years old and you're
yes.
to my right. Okay, and Billy Cruz, you're 18 years old.
Yeah, I'm 18 years old.
Okay. Kenshay, let me turn to you. What issue is most important to you right now?
Graduating and going to college is really important to me right now. I dreamed of going to a historically black college, but it's really expensive, so I'm worried how I can pay for that since I'm not rich and I don't want to take out loans because that'll set up debt for me.
You're touching on an issue that I think is so, so important to so many families right now. And I wonder, how have you been talking about this with your family in terms of how you can try to make this happen for you?
I don't really talk to my dad about the financial part of college. I just tell him where I got accepted and where I dream to go because he didn't go to college. So he doesn't really know what I'm going through. He doesn't know what it's like to apply to colleges and not getting accepted, worrying about my GPA and stuff like that. So I don't really go to him for advice.
Well, we're all rooting for you. I hope you get to a college that you really like.
Thank you.
Billy, you've actually been looking into this issue of college affordability, right?
Yeah, so film has been a passion of mine for most of my life. And I always thought when I was younger, like, I'm going to go to, like, the greatest film school I can, where the classes are amazing, but, like, the tuition's super high. And then I decided in the end to settle on a school that still is a really good film school, but it's also close by. But yeah, I have a clip that I was going to play for you, sort of my mom and me talking over the process because...
You interviewed your mom?
Yeah, wow. I interviewed my mom.
Well, let's listen to what she had to say. Yeah. Right?
It's scary because I have friends whose kids have gone to college and got there and they hated it. And it was out of state. And it's just one of those things, just like you would hate it if your kid went far away, paid all this money for them to go there, and now nobody's happy.
So she's talking about the risk of putting in a lot of money and investing a lot and finding out that you aren't happy and feeling like it wasn't worth it.
Yeah. That's a whole other, like, part of it. It's just going there and spending all this money only to realize, like, oh my God, I don't want to do this, or oh my God, this school isn't the school for me.
Kinshay, let's say things go well and you figure out a way to get to a college, university that you're really happy with. Take me 5 years down the road. What do you want to be doing? What's your dream?
I dream of becoming a lawyer. I think a public defender is the way that I want to go because I want to serve the people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if I don't do that, I have like a backup plan of being a therapist for children.
I like that. Desmond, what's your college situation?
I am a proud community college student. I rep Berkeley City College.
Uh-huh.
What Billy's talking about college buyer's remorse, like, that really resonates with me. I remember, like, being a senior, starting to apply to colleges and thinking about all the money I was going to spend, maybe having to take out a student loan and, like, put myself into debt. I chose to go to a community college, and I can transfer to a university or, you know, wherever I want after 2 years and basically spend half the money I would have spent on tuition.
Kinshay, is that an option for you? Would you talk to your dad about a community college maybe?
No. I think I'm opposite. I don't want to stay in Oakland. I actually want to start over and, like, meet new people.
Well, let me shift gears a tiny bit. This is an election year, and am I right? The three of you are going to be voting for the first time in this presidential election?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm so curious. Clearly, college affordability is something that's sort of on all of your minds. Billy, do you feel like your vote's going to count?
Yeah, I feel like if I don't vote, it definitely won't go anywhere. So at least I am able to say on a piece of paper that I felt this way about something. There's also other ways I feel like we could still make a difference. And whether or not my vote matters, I feel like I still have a voice.
Well, Kinshay, let me turn to you. You're at this really important moment in your life when you're thinking about your future, you're thinking about school, you're thinking about your dreams. I mean, do you feel like your vote matters in your life?
I don't think so. Like, I'm still going to vote, but I'm just going to hope that other people vote the same way that I do. Because, like, I'm only one person out of thousands of people.
Desmond, do you feel like voting is a place that is available to you to sort of bring change? Will your vote count?
I debate that with myself often. I just think that the money in politics, you know, is a real obstacle between democracy, quote-unquote, and actual democracy.
You feel like money has corrupted politics in a way?
I think so. I think that's undeniable. The other thing is that I think that candidates have historically really undervalued youth voters because there's this perception, there's some truth to that perception, mm-hmm. that young voters don't really turn out to elections and things like that. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that young people sort of feel disillusioned and like that they're not really valued. And so it's sort of almost like a vicious cycle.
How does that change?
When politicians start treating youth like voters and when they stop messing around on social media to try and like appeal to young people, like I'm going to tap that young vote if I send a Snapchat. It's like, No, we want you to talk to us like we have a brain because we do and because we're listening and we're really hard to appeal to. We're very diverse. We're a huge generation population wise and aspiration wise. I think we're a very motivated generation. We see a lot of problems in front of us.
Well, thanks to all three of you.
Thank you, David.
This has been super fun.
Thanks. See you later.
That was Desmond Megley, Kinshay Sakrice, and Billy Cruz. They're reporters here at Youth Radio. All this week on the show, we've been hearing
Youth Radio's music, and this is Oh Man from a young producer who goes by G-Baby. This is NPR News.
A revolution is happening. Cable companies are unbundling. They're offering fewer channels, and some viewers are losing their favorites.
It's nice to sit and watch something about farming and something that you really love, like animals, instead of those goofy Real Housewives.
The changing business of television, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered from 3 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, I'm David Green with a story of a village that is now flush with amenities. It's located on an island in the South Pacific. The village, Paunangisu, had a problem. Tourists just wouldn't visit. Their buses just drove by. But that's before the village built the best public toilet in the South Pacific. At least that's what the roadside billboard proclaims. Their logic, everyone likes a nice restroom. The toilet even has a website with a slogan that reads, "It's the place to go when you need to go." You're listening to Morning Edition.
It is 8:31 on this Friday. Thanks for being with us and hope you're having a great day so far. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Still to come this hour, it's Wisconsin Life. Today, we'll meet a Wisconsin poet who keeps chugging along through the season's unpredictable weather by cooking up a batch of her mother's brae. That's Wisconsin Life in 15 minutes.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Kimberly-Clark Corporation, home of Kleenex, Scott, and Huggies brands. More information about Kimberly-Clark's 143-year history is available on the web at kimberly-clark.com.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
Tune into Wisconsin Public Television Sunday night for the return of two masterpiece favorites. First, it's Grantchester. Tune in for an exciting whodunit with the handsome young priest. And then it's Mr. Selfridge. Three-time Emmy winner Jeremy Piven reprises his role as the colorful entrepreneur. Grantchester and Mr. Selfridge, Sunday night beginning at 8 on Wisconsin Public Television.
There is a chance of light rain in northwest Wisconsin later this afternoon. Otherwise, it should be mostly sunny elsewhere today. Highs will be in the mid to upper 30s in the east to the mid to upper 40s in northwest Wisconsin. Tonight, a chance of light rain and light snow in the northwest and a chance of light snow and light sleet in north central and northeast Wisconsin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals. Committed to helping people reach their financial goals, from saving for college to planning for retirement. More at letsmakeaplan.org. From MailChimp, offering MailChimp Pro, an enterprise-level email marketing platform with features like multivariate testing and advanced segmentation. Learn more at MailChimp.com/pro. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation at gatesfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Scientists are racing to stop the Zika epidemic. One key may be controlling the mosquito that transmits the Zika virus and other diseases like yellow fever and dengue. And that may involve releasing thousands of mosquitoes every day. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein traveled to Brazil to find out how that works.
It's just before dawn, and I'm standing on a corner in a small city in southeastern Brazil called Piracicaba. A big white van pulls up.
Bom dia.
Bom dia. It's Rob Stein from NPR.
Hi. Nice to meet you. Bom dia.
Out steps Guilherme Trivelato. He works for a biotech company that owns the van. Trivelato slides open the door and pulls out a big plastic pot. It's filled with mosquitoes. How many mosquitoes are in there?
Around 1,000 mosquitoes in each of those pots.
I look inside the van. It's jammed with crates filled with those plastic pots, swarming with mosquitoes.
Today we have 300 pots. 311 pots, so 311,000 mosquitoes.
That's how many you're going to release today?
Yeah, that's how mosquitoes are going to release today.
He's going to release thousands of mosquitoes in a place where mosquitoes are public enemy number one. Why? Why in the world would he do that? Well, these aren't just any mosquitoes. And these are all genetically engineered mosquitoes?
Yeah, they're all males, genetically engineered mosquitoes.
Okay, so for starters, these are all males. They don't bite. Only females bite. So these mosquitoes should not spread Zika or any other disease. And they're genetically engineered. That's how they could fight Zika. I asked him to explain, but it's time to get going. So we hop into the van and head out first. Trivolato launches an app on a tablet that beeps when it's time to
open the lid
and shove one of the plastic pots into a big tube sticking out a side window.
And let the mosquitoes start to do their job. Now they will fly around looking for the females.
So they can mate with them. Here's where the genetic engineering comes in. Scientists engineered these mosquitoes to carry a self-destruct gene, a deadly gene that they pass on to all their offspring, every single one.
All the offspring will die before reach adult phase, so we'll die before become a new flying mosquito.
That means they'll never have a chance to spread Zika.
Do you think that these mosquitoes will help stop Zika?
Sure, that's the idea. Stop any disease that are transmitted by these specific mosquitoes.
So Trivolato opens pod after pod of mosquitoes, block after block. He's been doing this 5 mornings a week, week after week, for months. But where do all these bugs come from? To find out, I head to a lab set up nearby by Oxitec, the British biotech company that created these mosquitoes, and ring the buzzer.
I'm Carla Tepedino from Oxitec.
Tepedino is going to give me a tour of the place.
Okay, so let's go.
She leads me through a sliding glass door, and we're immediately surrounded by mosquitoes, female genetically engineered mosquitoes. Tepedino grabs what looks like a tennis racket and starts swatting. What is that?
We kill the mosquitoes that are flying around. It's like electricity. They are being like electrocuted to death.
I don't have a hand free to do any electrocuting. I start to feel them biting. My hands, my neck, my forehead.
So right now that we arrived in this room, they got excited by our blood.
So yeah, I feel like I'm getting bitten. I'm getting mosquito bites.
Yeah, it happens.
Because these are females, so they're biting me.
Yeah.
But none of these mosquitoes have dengue or Zika, right?
Not at all, really.
You sure?
Yeah, we do tests on that.
That's a relief. Females bite to get the blood they need to make eggs, and the biotech company needs their eggs to breed the males to release into the wild. Technicians hatch the eggs in trays filled with fish food, and then use strainers to separate the immature males from the females.
Males are smaller, females are bigger.
The males are then transferred into those plastic pots I saw in the van, where they emerge, ready to fly and spread their self-destruct gene. Back in the Oxitec van, Guilherme Trivolato is getting near the end of his route.
So how do you feel about these mosquitoes? Do you like them?
Yeah, to be honest, I really like them. I know the first time we were releasing the mosquitoes, you have that bad impression because you see it's mosquito after all. But once you start to live with them, because it's what we are doing now, it's easy to understand why we call it the friendly mosquito.
Friendly because the company claims they can cut down the number of disease-spreading mosquitoes by 80 to 90%.
Really exciting for us. Really comforting for us to know that we are doing the right thing.
But not everyone agrees. José Fejaz is an ecologist at a local university. He questions how well these mosquitoes really work and worries they could mess up the environment somehow and backfire, making it easier for other mosquitoes to spread diseases.
I'm worried because the population shouldn't be lab rats. They're not lab rats, they're people, their lives.
So I decide to ask a few people outside a grocery store in the neighborhood where the mosquitoes are being released to see what they think. Some share the professor's fears and worry these could turn out to be some kind of super mosquitoes that are even more dangerous. but others are glad the mosquitoes are in town.
Isso aí preocupa muito.
Elder Sanshin has a daughter-in-law who's pregnant, so he's worried about Zika, which may be causing severe birth defects.
Eu não tenho nenhuma gestante na família, né?
People think, oh, I don't have a pregnant person in the family. Okay.
Mas a partir do momento que você tem na família uma gestante, a preocupação é imensa.
It's an immense worry.
But Sanshin admits it's hard to get used to letting these genetically engineered mosquitoes buzz all around his living room so they can breed.
Normalmente, quando você tem insetos
in your house,
a primeira coisa que você faz, pega o inseticida e pulverize.
You pulverize them,
então
but not in this case.
Você
you
deixa,
don't pulverize
né?
them, you yeah. leave them.
Now, this isn't the only new approach that looks promising for controlling Zika mosquitoes. Other scientists are experimenting with mosquitoes infected with bacteria or sterilized by radiation. But the Brazilian government is considering letting Oxitec release its mosquitoes all over the country. And in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration is trying to decide whether to let the mosquitoes loose in one town in Florida. Rob Stein, NPR News, Piracicaba, Brazil.
This is NPR News. It's 8:41 on this Friday. Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have headlines coming up next, and in 10 minutes, it's the Marketplace Morning Report.
This is Norman Gilliland. I'll be aboard this fall when WPR Travel follows in the footsteps of Mozart, Bach, and Beethoven with a cruise along the Danube River. On day four, we explore Prague Castle, which includes a variety of palaces and churches with architecture ranging from the 10th through the 14th century. That evening, we'll enjoy a classical music concert. A full itinerary for our October Blue Danube trip with Earthbound Expeditions is available at wpr.org/travel.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Brussels today, where Belgian lawmakers are looking at tougher anti-terrorism measures following this week's bombings. ISIS says it was behind the attacks that killed 31 people, including two Americans. Earlier, Kerry was in Moscow for talks on Syria with Russian President Vladimir Putin. NPR's Corey Flintoff is in Moscow.
Secretary Kerry says they agreed to try to strengthen the current ceasefire, mainly by stopping either side from trying to seize new territory, and also by banning the use of indiscriminate weapons like cluster bombs that kill civilians.
In the NCAA Men's Division I basketball tournament, the overall top seed, Kansas, is advancing to the South Regional Final after beating Maryland 79-63. Greg Eklund reports.
Going into the South Regional Final, Kansas is 33-4 this season. They've won 17 straight, and the Jayhawks are trying for their third Final Four under Coach Bill Self, the first since 2012.
Kansas next plays Villanova. In the West region, Oregon moves on after knocking off Duke, and Oklahoma advances after beating Texas A&M. The Commerce Department says the U.S. economy grew 1.4% in the final quarter of last year. That's stronger than earlier estimates. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump is headed to Wisconsin next week. Trump's website says he'll appear Tuesday at a conference center in Janesville, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan's hometown. Ryan delivered a veiled rebuke to Trump's divisive campaign rhetoric this week, decrying in a speech how ugly politics have become. The presidential candidates have been ramping up their presence in the state just ahead of the state's April 5th primary. Ohio Governor John Kasich and Texas Senator Ted Cruz both made campaign stops outside Milwaukee on Wednesday. Cruz planned to campaign in the state through today, and Kasich will be back in Wisconsin on Monday with a stop in West Salem. Chelsea Clinton visited with Wisconsin campaign officers on behalf of her mother, Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton, yesterday. And Bernie Sanders is hosting a rally at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison tomorrow afternoon. A defense contractor in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, has picked up about $676 million in federal contracts to build and update military vehicles. The U.S. Army granted Oshkosh Corporation, Wisconsin's largest federal contractor, three renewal contracts totaling $433 million this week. The Army also awarded the company an additional $243 million contract on Wednesday. USA Today Network Wisconsin reports the contracts represent the first wave of an award that could net $30 billion over time. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles, at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. March weather can be unpredictable in Wisconsin, tossing blue skies and warm sun with snow and bitter winds. To keep herself grounded, Chris Sirogi cooks up a batch of her mother's Bray.
The snow banks shrink, water streams and rivulets to the ditches, and a south wind blows. It is that in-between time, time between cold and warmth. We are teased with a warm sun, but the north wind still bites, especially so as we have foolishly and stylishly set aside the heavy wool coats and snow pants for a lighter weight fabric. It is March, kite flying weather. Many a time I stood out in the cold March wind flying kites with my children, but with our frozen fingers and numbed legs, the kite surged on its string alone, quite abandoned to a stake as we retreated to the house to warm up. Still, Wisconsinites have been known to make the best of strange weather. As such, this March I have decided to set aside my kite flying and instead stir up a batch of Bray. That's what my mother called this unusual dish of pork roast, buckwheat flour, and spices, though I found nothing on the web by that name. I checked the St. Boniface Mother's Favorite Recipes cookbook, and though four versions of the recipe are given in the 1969 edition, my mother's copy, the recipe is not even mentioned in the 1995 Heart of Our Home edition, my copy. Searching by ingredients, I finally came up with scrapple, a Pennsylvania Dutch dish that was somewhat similar. Mom served Bray to us for breakfast. She mixed it up, put it in bread pans, and refrigerated it. The next morning, it was sliced and fried in lard until crispy brown and dished onto a serving platter. The aromatic fragrance of fried fat and cooked cloves and sage drifted over our large country kitchen. We'd fork crusty slices onto our plates and thickly pour white caro syrup, covering every edge. My father would layer his between freshly baked buttered bread. We devoured it as fast as my mom fried it. Of course, by the time she thankfully sat down to her share, we had ambled from the table to begin our daily chores. My mom sat alone with her coffee and her creation, though always somewhat disappointed. It just didn't taste as good as her mom's. In my married life, I've only prepared Bray a few times. A couple of times, we also bought a dense loaf of Bray at the grocery store. It tasted noticeably different. Out of curiosity, I called around to several stores to see if any make the product for their deli. Alas, no one cooks it. So the tradition of this breakfast buckwheat toast will have to continue with me. I vowed not to let March toss me about this year. I will wear jeans and underalls to keep warm and hang onto that winter coat. I will save my kite flying for warmer April days. And I will buy a pork roast and buckwheat flour and sit my 90-year-old mother onto a chair next to my stove in her pink booties. I will measure, cook, stir, and taste until this dish stands ready for my family once again.
Chris Sorogi is a writer and poet in De Pere. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook. It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and stay with us. The music starts at 9. Today's playlist includes a symphony by Haydn that was written for Holy Week, a march by William Walton, and a new release to sample. Join Stephanie Elkins for Morning Classics in 10 minutes, right after the Marketplace Morning Report, next here on WPR.
Support comes from the Jazz Appreciation Month concert series at Fusion in downtown Kenosha. First up is the Lesser Lake Trio. Friday evening, April 1st, tickets are $8 for adults, $5 for seniors and students. More at KenoshaFusion.com.
Comedies and moving dramas. WPR is pleased to support film festivals in Wisconsin. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
There is a chance of light rain in northwest Wisconsin later this afternoon and mostly sunny elsewhere in the state. Highs will be in the mid to upper 30s in the east to the mid to upper 40s in the northwest.
Support for WPR comes from Goodwill Industries of North Central Wisconsin, where donations help to support nearly 30 programs touching 63,000 people across 35 counties last year. Goodwill, elevating people, transforming communities.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Career opportunities abound in marketing, including public relations, advertising, promotion, and international marketing. Improve your degree through an articulation agreement with one of 35 colleges and universities. Check out marketing at gtc.edu.
Who's to blame when your Netflix bogs down like the data is caught in the sand?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Constant Contact, a proud Marketplace sponsor for 8 years, committed to helping small businesses succeed with email marketing. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Epson. With high-precision industrial robots installed in factories worldwide, Epson's robots are designed to help businesses improve product quality. Where there's business, there's Epson.
From Marketplace in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. A key regulatory issue guiding the great shift from regular television to online digital TV are intentional bottlenecks called throttling, and Netflix likes to accuse internet service providers of squeezing down their data flow. But as the Wall Street Journal first reported, it turns out that Netflix also slows its own data in certain cases for people who want to watch shows on smartphones. For help with this, we turn to our technology reporter, Brian Fung, is at the Washington Post.
Because video uses up a lot of your data, people who are on plans that have really strict data caps could wind up going through those data caps really quickly if they watch a lot of Netflix. So Netflix doesn't want you to blow through your data cap all at once just by watching a whole bunch of Netflix. So what it does is that it restricts the speed of your video stream to about 600 kilobits per second, which is just above the minimum bandwidth required for Netflix to even work on a device. Netflix's own site recommends that you have a connection speed of about six times as much just to watch a standard definition stream.
But this is a shift in the story because there had been dark suspicions that the internet service providers are somehow crimping the style of Netflix because often the internet service providers have rival TV services.
That's right. What we haven't really talked about yet is Netflix's role in trying to set internet policy. It's been very active in Washington in trying to get regulators to intervene against internet providers who, it has accused in the past of trying to meddle with internet traffic or slow down Netflix's speeds. And so it's kind of ironic now to see Netflix taking advantage of some of these similar tactics.
Irony indeed. Brian Fung covers tech for the Washington Post. Brian, thank you.
My pleasure.
And after much speculation, there's also news that Apple has figured out what its first big TV show will be about as it tries to go up against the likes of Netflix and Amazon to produce original content. Imagine the possibilities given House of Cards on Netflix or Transparent on Amazon Prime. Apple's new show, ready for this, will be an unscripted series about smartphone apps. Before we judge, know that the wonderful Will I Am of Black Eyed Peas will be helping with this. Now to a big shift at Sony. It's forming a new company called ForwardWorks, which will make games for smartphones starting in Japan. For the most part, Sony's been focusing on making expensive games for its PlayStation console, Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
The mobile gaming market is a $35 billion opportunity, according to market researcher Newzoo. But unlike console games, the money comes in very small doses.
Smartphone gaming doesn't make nearly as much profit margin.
Melissa Schilling is a management professor at NYU's business school. Popular smartphone games sell for nothing, making money by purchases people make while playing. That means Sony has to figure out how to make games that appeal to a lot more people.
It doesn't mean that Sony can't be successful in this market, but it's going to have to work a lot harder at it.
Don't mistake Sony and Nintendo's smartphone moves as abandoning hardcore console gamers. That's still a strong business, one set to transform as virtual reality improves. Macquarie analyst Ben Schachter says smartphone gaming opens up a whole new market.
It's much more about a casual experience that can be played very quickly, much more about an experience that can be enjoyed by many different demographics.
Young and old, male and female, everybody with a smartphone is now in Sony's crosshairs. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Most financial markets are closed around the world today. The S&P 500 on this Good Friday is down 1.2% year to date. They left us with crude just under $40 a barrel, a euro costing less than $1.11, and a 10-year treasury yield at 1.9%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Kronos, with cloud-based workforce management solutions designed for organizations to maximize their most valued asset, their workforce. Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by the Candida Fund, working to advance individual dignity and sustainable communities through investments in transformative leaders and ideas. CandidaFund.org.
When it comes to money, there are no guarantees. There is always, always an element of risk, except in one area, or so we thought. Marketplace regular and Washington Post columnist Alan Sloan joins us now. Alan, good morning.
Good morning, David.
After all these years of covering money in markets, you thought you had identified just one fail-safe investment. What was this instrument?
Forever stamps.
Like from the post office?
Like from the post office.
Right. The stamp with no denomination, always and forever, until the universe pulls back on itself and shrinks everything into a black hole, that forever stamp would be good for the postage on a first-class letter, but no?
Well, yes, except now for the first time in almost 100 years, it looks like the price of a first-class letter could drop.
Oh, wait. So the cost of mailing it could drop. Why?
It's a strange, complicated, regulatory thing. Basically, on April 10th, unless something happens between now and then, the price of a first-class stamp is going to drop to 47 cents from 49 cents, where it's been since January of 2014.
And you get stuck with these stinking forever stamps that cost you 49 cents. And what, if you, each time you use it, potentially, you'd lose 2 cents?
Right. You have lost the opportunity to pay 47 cents to mail something.
How many of these stamps are you using in a month, my friend?
Well, not very many, but I still use some, and I have about 150 of these things in my house because I don't want to have to go wait online in the post office.
Yeah, and I buy them one at a time, which is probably not smart, but is there a lesson here for us in the possibility that mailing might get cheaper, therefore you'd be overpaying if you used it forever?
Yeah, the lesson I've learned is that just when you think you have figured something out, you realize that nothing is forever.
You know, Alan, you no longer have to be dead to be on a U.S. stamp. I vote for an Alan Sloan stamp because you, sir, are a first-class kind of a guy.
And we have to think outside the envelope.
All right, we'll stop now. Mr. Sloan is also editor-at-large at ProPublica. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure, Dave.
Actually, why stop now? This is why he's called a Washington Post columnist. Stock and bond markets are closed today for the Easter weekend. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
And this is WPR, where there's news for you today and over the weekend. We have headlines at noon every day, and our morning and afternoon news programs also air every day. Schedules are a little bit different on Saturday and Sunday. You can find details and lots of stories as well at WPR.org.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include the Edward J. Okray Foundation, the Spring Green Chamber, and Present Music. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support comes from Andrea's, Kenosha's Easter store since 1911, featuring Fannie Mae buttercream eggs, Madeline milk dark and white chocolate bunnies, old-fashioned fruit-flavored pectin jelly beans, and so much more. Andrea's, 24th Avenue and 60th Street, Kenosha. You're listening to WGTD 8.